and uphold our responsibility to make sure that, you know, our families and our communities are part of the ecosystems. And, you know, when you look at a beautiful forest, it's so diverse. And it's the diversity that makes it rich. But there's one thing missing, and that's Indigenous people. And so it's very important that we go back and be a part of our environment again, because we bring a diversity that's very important as stewards. Because in a very diverse ecosystem, everything gives everything to everything. And because we've been removed, the natural land and water protectors have been removed, everything's been open wide for resource extraction. And now we're in, of course, abrupt climate change and severe ecological collapse. This is happening all over the world. This is just isn't happening here. So to me, it's, you know, land back is being part of the ecological solution. You know, they used to call us the Indian problem, you know, being a free people in our lands. And, you know, having our own government, having our own language, having our own sustainable economy. You know, all of these things was called the Indian problem because we were free, the Bedouin. But really, we're not the Indian problem. You know, we're part of the ecological solution. Because when we're introduced back into our natural habitats, there's a great, great benefit. And it can actually stop the domino effect that happens, you know, ecologically when things start to fall apart. And so we are medicine to the land, and we need to go back. The land will heal if we go back. We will heal if we go back. That's what the elders always told me growing up anyway.
So in what way are you helping the youth reconnect with culture now?
So there's a team of us at Nipki Ajbikong, and, you know, there's a youth collective, you know, there's elders. So everybody's kind of doing really cool stuff. You know, there's like brain tan, moose hiding stuff that goes on where the kids learn how to brain tan the moose hides. There's fishing, there's basket making, there's moccasin making, you know, and hat making, there's glove making, there's like just everything that you can think of, you know, generally goes on there. And, you know, there's culture camps that happen as well. So I'm facilitating, I have a few culture camps coming up where we take kids on the land and we teach them the plants and some of the trees and the natural surroundings and the language. We introduce them back to the Anishinaabe Mon names of the places. But we're going to really try to connect their spirits to the land as much as we can, you know, through language and land-based activities.
Isaac Murdoch is an activist, artist, and activator of communities across the country. For more on both Christy Belcourt and Isaac Murdoch, I encourage you to check out the website, nimkiajbikong.com. You can find the websites I've mentioned in the show notes. Thanks for listening. Canada Land Back is a co-production between Canada's National Observer and Canada Land. It's hosted and produced by Karen Pugliese. That's me, and producer Kim Wheeler.
Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
Luke Savage, staff writer at Jacobin, co-host of the Michael and Us podcast, and guy whose career once got a boost from Glenn Greenwald back at a time when that was really a big positive. Welcome to Shortcuts.
Thanks so much for having me, Jonathan. It still feels like a luxury to, you know, record a podcast in person.
Very glad to have you here. Today on the show, how to blow up a pipeline, or where statecraft meets Minecraft. I'm Jonathan Goldsby. Welcome to Shortcuts, where we talk about the news. Thank you.
U.S. officials scramble after a document leak, including reportedly sensitive intel on the war in Ukraine.
Pro-Russian hackers allegedly targeting a Canadian company.
This leak had been traced back to a Discord server about video games and YouTubers.
In regards to the reports of cyber attacks against Canadian energy infrastructure, I can confirm that there was no physical damage to any Canadian energy infrastructure following cyber attacks.
As the Globe and Mail put it, that was a carefully phrased statement from the Prime Minister on Tuesday. There was no physical damage, leaving open the possibility, I suppose, of emotional damage or spiritual damage or mostly...
Was the pipeline okay?
Yeah, how does the pipeline feel? Is it spiritually coherent? Is it still looking for its purpose? Most likely, if it wasn't physical damage, there could have been economic damage that could, you know, the sort that could be caused by a system that's been compromised or disrupted, but not, you know, actually blown up. But let's take a step back. So on Sunday afternoon, the New York Times published a report with the headline, "A pro-Russian hacking group may have targeted Canada's energy infrastructure." The 600-word web story was just one item in a larger roundup the Times published, offering an overview of miscellaneous revelations contained in a trove of Pentagon documents that had basically just appeared online. A few hours after the Times story, the Globe followed up with its own report, which later found a place of prominence on the top of Monday's paper. So both stories offered summaries of a seemingly authentic U.S. intelligence assessment based on intercepted communications between a group of hackers and the FSB, which is Russia's state security apparatus, the successor to the KGB. And so the semi-independent hacking group known as Zarya had essentially boasted to the FSB that they'd managed to gain remote access to a Canadian gas pipeline such that they'd be able to fiddle with the controls and cause it to shut down or perhaps even blow up. The FSB officers anticipated a successful operation would cause an explosion at the gas distribution station and were monitoring Canadian news reports for indications of an explosion. The Times quoted the assessment as saying, "The U.S. believed the goal wasn't to cause loss of life, but rather economic damage, and that as of the end of February, the hackers were awaiting guidance on what to do next." So the geopolitical implications are interesting, really interesting, but I'm actually kind of more fascinated by the chain of events that led to us learning about this, or at least learning what the U.S. thinks about this. What did you make of it when this came to your attention?
Well, I do think the story is interesting and that there's a lot to discuss here. I mean, I think we're going to talk about a lot of different things related to this particular leak. But when it comes to this specific question of the pipeline, I actually, frankly, don't see a whole lot here. I mean, the Globe story right off the top, you know, there are a number of pretty important qualifiers. You know, the first thing is that the hacking group is actually independent of the Russian government. They're making a claim. Mm-hmm. And the claim, at least as the Globe's article frames it, is, you know, they didn't claim to have, as I understand it, the capability, you know, to disrupt pipeline infrastructure. They claim to have done so. Globe and Mail report goes on to say that, you know, the documents themselves in the leak are unverified. And, you know, I guess we'll get to that. There's a lot of, you know, debate about what these documents actually are, whether they've been tampered with, by who, et cetera. And there are conflicting accounts, even from within, even from Ukrainian versus American officials about what these documents are and the, you know, intended purpose of the leak, that kind of thing. But again, in the case of this pipeline story, the documents in the leak are unverified. And secondly, there's no evidence that any such attack occurred. So whatever this group is claiming, it doesn't seem to be accurate.
It was weird. Until Trudeau's line came to my attention about there having been no physical damage, I definitely put this more in the realm of the hypothetical, highly qualified, and whatever. To me, the fact that, and this is just something that occurred to me this morning before we recorded this, as I saw this quote, is like, oh, that doesn't mean anything did happen, but certainly qualifying it that way leaves open at the very least the possibility that something could have happened. And that to me was a little more like, oh, okay, so they're not coming out and ruling that out or excluding that. But yeah, as with any intelligence assessment, as with any intelligence, many potential places for this game of broken telephone to have broken down, to have eroded, whether it was this hacking group maybe just lying for the sake of making themselves sound better, whether it was lying for the sake of, you know, throwing off whoever may be eavesdropping, who knows? There are definitely a lot of qualifiers, and yet it also kind of seems just plausible enough. Like, it seems kind of plausible that it'd be easier for Russian hackers to get into the infrastructure of a Canadian gas pipeline more easily than you can get a cell phone signal on the TTC. But to zoom out a little bit further, and sort of how this information eventually came to this point where the Prime Minister is offering these qualified response. The two biggest U.S. intelligence leaks the past decade or so were, of course, the diplomatic cables that Chelsea Manning gave to WikiLeaks in 2010 and the NSA documents that Edward Snowden shared with a handful of journalists in 2013. And in both cases, those were pretty deliberate acts with unambiguous whistleblower intentions. This very much seems to be a lot stupider, kind of a cross between Burn After Reading and Glass Onion. It's just so farcically unsophisticated as to pretty much dispel any notion that there could be some higher end to it. Because whether you're a whistleblower trying to get this out and affect change, or whether you're a state actor trying to seed disinformation, this is probably not how you do it because it's kind of too stupid.
What we know is that a lot of this stuff was dropped in places like Discord servers. It was posted on 4chan. I guess the funniest one is there's a Discord server called Minecraft Earth Map where some of this stuff was put. I have no special insight here except, I guess, to just agree with what you just said. I mean, if you're trying to leak documents, this is a very stupid and kind of trolly way to do so. I mean, I guess perhaps it could be a tactic, you know, if you want to leak a bunch of sensitive documents, perhaps it makes sense to, you know, put them somewhere that is not explicitly connected to the substance of or the content of what's in the leaks, but nevertheless, where there's a very big user base and where, you know, somebody's going to see it.
Yeah, so thanks in large part to reporting by Bellingcat's Eric Toller, later echoed by the Associated Press and others, we sort of have a rough idea of the chain of events that led to the ruining of Easter plans for intelligence officials and national security journalists the world over. Because it wasn't even just a matter of, like, seeding it in a few places. What we believe, or what Eric Toller's reported, is that perhaps as far back as January, there's a Discord, and Discord is kind of like, how would you describe Discord, Luke?
It's a very chaotic platform that I tried to set up for my podcast once, couldn't figure it out, and gave up.
That sounds fair. I've never actually used it. My understanding is it's kind of like Slack for non-work purposes. So there's a Discord called Thug Shaker Central, which is offensive, but not so offensive that I feel uncomfortable saying it, which Bellingcat says was basically a couple dozen people who are interested in video games, music, Orthodox Christianity, and fandom for a YouTuber called Oxide. That seems to be the place where they first trickled out. It's not yet clear who the original person was, but from there it seems to have gradually spread outwards, but very, very gradually. By the start of March, there were 30 documents on a Discord devoted to WowMow, which is a popular Filipino YouTuber I hadn't heard of. By a few days later, the March 4th, they then got into the Minecraft Earth Map Discord, where, as Bellingcat put it, after a brief spat with another person on the server about Minecraft maps and the war in Ukraine, one of the Discord users replied, "Here, have some leaked documents," which I just love. By this month, Wednesday, April 5th, those filtered onto Paul, or the politically incorrect board of 4chan. How would you describe 4chan, Luke?
I mean, I guess 8chan or 8kun, I don't know if that's still up, but, you know, before that, you know, 4chan was considered, you know, the part of the internet, sort of like the least moderated part of the internet. It's where you found, like, the most offensive memes and that kind of thing. I guess, you know, it had a tie-in with sort of, you know, the alt-right and Gamergate and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, also, like, a lot of the great memes, like Rickrolling and many things, a weird number of things in our culture.
That's right. It's a very anarchic place, and I think sometimes it's encoded as being, like, purely right-wing. That's true, but I think a lot of it was also pretty apolitical and just a place where people would share stuff that was sometimes actually quite innocuous. It was just goofy.
Yeah, shitposting. I mean, it seemed to describe as, like, the ass end of the internet. Like, it used to be, like, the worst place in the internet, but now, actually, there are a few worse places, but it's one of the worst places.
I actually think there's one other way of looking at 4chan, which is that I think it also sort of represented a holdover from an earlier era of the internet, because, you know, before social media, really, you know, before Facebook was launched in sort of, what, 2004, 2005, something like that, YouTube, about the same thing, but sort of in an earlier era of the internet, it really was much more of a Wild West. It was much more anonymous. It was much more kind of forum-based, and the forums were much more kind of decentralized. I think 4chan was sort of a holdover from that as well.
Yeah, I guess that is one way to look at it, and sort of similar how everything the internet has kind of eroded over time as different sorts of bad actors, including often on the far right, have learned to game algorithms and other particular forms and other mediums. The runes of a once, if not great, then maybe once okay or tolerable civilization So from 4chan, it seems to have then spread to a Russian Telegram channel called Donbass Devushka. From there, that seems to be where the New York Times and national security people first kind of started, first noticed it, and why it only happened to break over the Easter weekend. And I did spend some time, probably too much time, trying to track down the original document in this case, and 4chan pretty much is the only place to go for that. And I found a whole bunch of them, and it's really interesting to see these documents. None of them are scans. They're all photographs. They're all, the pages are yellow. Most of them, except for one that has very clearly been manipulated, the big piece that has sown doubt about the authenticity of these, or whether they may have been authentic at one point and subsequently manipulated, was one slide that, of which there are two versions, one of which definitely appears to have clearly been manipulated. I believe it just transposes some numbers to exaggerate Ukrainian casualties and play down Russian ones, which is the sort of, you know, Russian disinformation that they would engage in, that, you know, in the form of an authentic-looking document, say, oh, you know, this is actually the case, more people died. So that's the thing that's largely cast doubt on this. Anyway, I could not find the particular thing about Canada, but I spent quite a lot of time in 4chan, too much time. I've seen a lot of horrible things. But I did find a tweet from a guy who appeared to have copies of all of them and was inundated with requests from reporters, including from the Globe and Mail, Stephen Chase, who chimed in Saturday evening. Another reporter here, would you please DM me the photos? Thanks. So based on all of this, when we talk about intelligence leaks in the context of media, I mean, we think about the stuff reports about maybe Chinese interference. Where do you feel like this fits in within the history of leaks and media and intelligence leaks? Like, how would you contextualize this?
Well, I think it's very difficult, particularly after, you know, in the immediate wake of something like this, to, you know, evaluate its veracity. And in the piece you cited from Bellingcat, I mean, there are a number of different officials who are quoted or alluded to who all seem to be taking very different lines on what the nature of this leak is. So Ukrainian officials are casting, you know, doubt on the veracity of the information. You know, U.S. officials seem to be suggesting that, or, you know, they seem to want to suggest that, you know, the documents are authentic. You know, the Russian position, at least as they've communicated to CNN, is that actually this is NATO engaging in, you know, cyber warfare or, you know, disinformation. But then there's a pro-Russian Telegram channel, possibly the same one you mentioned. And they say they're not convinced that, you know, the documents, you know, are Western disinformation, right? So in terms of the specifics of the leak, I really have no idea. The fact that there are conflicting reports, I suppose, is interesting. What I would say is with any unverified intelligence leak, it's good to have a posture of maximum skepticism at all times. Regardless of what the source of the leak is, regardless of whether it's, you know, coming from Russia or whether it's coming from the United States or a Western-aligned country. Suffice it to say that there is a very storied history of unverified intelligence leaks being used by state actors of all kinds to mold a narrative in a way that's, you know, self-interested for them. The Iraq War, possibly one of the most sinister cases I can think of this happening. You know, I was actually revisiting for a piece last month some of the media coverage in the lead up to that war. I mean, it's unbelievable. You know, you have a lot of outlets that are ostensibly independent, I mean, basically acting as appendages of the U.S. state. And one of the things that kind of enabled that, one of the ways that that was done was through the publication of unverified intelligence leaks. So to give you a concrete example, there was a technique that the investigative journalist Seymour Hersh labeled stovepiping. And, you know, this was a method that I guess has its origins, as I understand it, within intelligence agencies. So, you know, if you're Dick Cheney or Donald Rumsfeld, and you don't like the things that your own officials are telling you, which presumably have gone through some kind of process, there's been some kind of filter, you can sidestep that process and you can instead appeal to kind of lower level parts of the bureaucracy that are still working with things that, you know, haven't been processed as much, haven't been verified, and you can just, you know, find what intelligence agencies look into all kinds of things, right? So presumably at some point you're going to find something that fits your preferred narrative and you're just going to go with that. And in some cases, that kind of stuff was leaked to the press, materials that are completely unverified and often wouldn't even contain a concrete claim. It would be like U.S. intelligence officials are looking into X, Y, and Z. But then that appears in the New York Times, the Washington Post, a very reputable source. And it kind of has the veil of independence because it looks like this is something a media outlet is reporting on. They've gotten access to exclusive information. They're revealing something. Mm. And what that allows for is then, you know, Dick Cheney goes on TV and he says, well, it's not me talking about Iraq's, you know, burgeoning weapons of mass destruction capabilities. You can read about it in the New York Times. But, you know, really, it's coming straight from the U.S. intelligence bureaucracy and it's not verified to begin with. So, I mean, that's just one. And granted, it's a particularly sinister example.
Formative one that's, I think, informed how everyone who grew up around that time, and we're both millennials, I think the people who think about these things realize that media can be overly credulous and culpable, which is something that I think, for example, the perspective has been very helpful. I found very helpful to bring to the case, you know, all the reports about Chinese interference and trying to figure out what could the motivations for leaking this be? What is the legitimacy of this intelligence? How much should we qualify this? In the case of these alleged or supposed Pentagon papers, I find myself not being as skeptical of this. I mean, there's this inverse thing where the harder it is to track down, the weirder the route it took to get to us, the more I'm inclined to believe it. And for all I know, that could itself just be another technique that it's used to add undue credibility. It's sprinkled out in a way that doesn't seem like it could be any, it at least seems too stupid to be anything other than organic. So one thing that maybe lends a little credibility, but not really, is that on Tuesday, the websites of the Prime Minister's office and the Canadian Senate were briefly taken offline by a Russian DDoS attack. That's a direct denial of service attack when a website's just bombarded with traffic till it overloads. And those were presumably to coincide with the Ukrainian Prime Minister, not Zelensky, the Prime Minister, meeting with Trudeau in Toronto. But of course, there's also a really big difference between a DDoS attack. I mean, who hasn't been subject to that? And, you know, getting into pipeline infrastructure.
So nobody could go to the Senate of Canada's website.
I know.
Devastating.
It's a good website, I found, actually. I've had occasion to browse it recently. The fact that it was the Senate, not even the House of Commons, does suggest that it was a foreign actor that isn't aware that, yeah,
it's not the United States Senate. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Lucas, you probably know, on the show, we like to duly note things. Today, I'd like to note duly the situation at Cape Breton University. We all basically know at this point that post-secondary institutions in Canada are overly reliant on international students for as a source of revenue and typically inadequately support them or fail to sufficiently support them once they're here. Thanks to a segment on CTSW5.
Students, lured by promises of a quality education, left hungry, broke, and desperate.
There are no houses here. There are no jobs here.
I wouldn't let anybody live in that.
I learned that Cape Breton University in Sydney, Nova Scotia, sort of takes this to an extreme beyond what we've seen elsewhere. And not only is a majority of the student population international students, like three quarters, they've basically recruited more students than the city can physically accommodate. I mean, you know, a lot of places in Canada have affordable housing problems. It's very difficult for anyone to get affordable housing in any Canadian city. But it's gone to a point there where at least it appears that the university has kind of like created a homelessness crisis with people basically living in slum accommodations, sleeping in cars, basically staying with just families rent-free because they don't want to sleep on the streets, overwhelm the public transit system. And they don't have the classroom space, so they rented like a Cineplex theater 9 kilometers away to ship students off to. It's kind of remarkable. And I mean, it makes me worry that like, is this where all of Canada is kind of headed? Not in terms of like, oh, we're going to have too much immigration or anything like that, but rather we've already failed to build out the infrastructure we need to support anyone, the people we hear. We want more people. We do a decent job of welcoming people, or at least of inviting people. We don't do a great job of keeping up with the infrastructure, whether it's affordable housing, whether it's transit, whether it's anything like that. At what point does any given population pass that sort of tipping point where what we have and even what we could plausibly build can no longer support or contain our population? What sort of investment would it take right now to avoid the entire country turning out a bit like Sydney, Nova Scotia?
Well, I think what we can or can't finance is very much a political question. And I mean, I think that whether we're talking about homelessness among international students at Cape Breton University and the sort of public infrastructure there not being adequate to meet their needs, or whether we're talking about homelessness in general, I mean, those things are in many ways just a direct consequence of treating public institutions like universities and the question of housing more generally, approaching those things with a market logic, you know, treating housing more as a speculative commodity than as, you know, a social need. The fact is we just need a lot more public housing and greater investment in public infrastructure in general, whether we're talking about universities or anything else, transit, et cetera. When it comes to housing, we need to put social need above, you know, the treatment of housing as a speculative commodity or as purely a site of profit.
And maybe not to the same extent, but people need education. Of course, the big reason that universities rely more on international students is because governments have not really greatly increased their per capita funding of universities, whereas their caps, their limits to how much they're allowed to charge domestic students, they can basically charge market rates to international students. And so trying to let the market fill in this gap or fill this hole. There are people who genuinely think that is the solution to everything. I've never really seen that that's been a solution to anything.
Duly noted.
Now, Luke, what would you like to note duly today?
Well, I will duly note a story that comes out of the United States. I mean, forgive me for offering a U.S. example here. That's where my head is often these days because of my job. This one comes courtesy of my friend Adam Johnson, who's a media critic. Mm. You can find his work on Substack and at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. He recently published a piece on his Substack, CNN Sunday morning shows completely ignore up to 15 million Americans being thrown off of Medicaid.
Mm.
So this is a recent development in the United States. I mean, very significant in terms of the social consequences. It has to do with the kind of phasing out of various pandemic era kind of emergency programs, social supports, eviction protections, and then, you know, eligibility for certain programs, including Medicaid. And what Adam did basically is look at all the cable news coverage of this and found that, you know, it was more or less completely elided by all the major shows, which is to say they didn't even really cover it at all. So if you watched cable news, you know, within the window of time that Adam looked into, you would basically not be aware that 15 million people, you know, are about to lose their medical coverage. You know, he notes that print media did straight reports, but, quote, the framing was entirely in PSA format, how the individual reader or viewer could avoid becoming a victim of these cuts and how to best navigate the deliberately opaque system of benefits. In none of the reports was there any sense that this was a political debate with a potential political solution. It simply happened like a tornado or earthquake. One of the reasons why I chose this story is because, you know, we're talking today about fake news and disinformation and that kind of thing. And I think it's important to note that you can also have a kind of disinformation, as it were, of omission. Oftentimes when the media misleads people, I think, you know, it's not by directly lying to them. It's just by offering narrative parameters, which kind of foreclose alternative ways, perhaps, of thinking about something. In this case, the fact that the Medicaid question, as Adam says, is a political question.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a random weather event. This is, you know, being decided by political institutions, the Biden administration, Congress, etc.
I love that framing. Narrative parameters. Duly noted. That's Shortcuts for this week. Thanks for joining me, Luke.
Thanks for having me, Jonathan. A pleasure as always.
Oh, thank you. We are on Twitter at Candleland. I think Jesse has said we're basically staying on it until the ship, whole freaking ship goes down. I'm still technically on Twitter, sort of. I am. You can email me at jonathan@candleland.com. I will read, at the very least, read everything you send. Where can people find you, Luke?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter at Luke W. Savage. And you can find Michael and Us, my podcast, on SoundCloud, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, your podcast app of choice, and at patreon.com/Michael and Us.
This episode is produced by Aviva Lassard with additional production by Tristan Capicchione. Our managing editor is Annette Ajofo. Theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Check them out online, cfuv.ca.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. For 19-year-old Danielle Frank, California's Trinity River is a cultural lifeline.
We are water people, we are river people, and we believe that when our river drains and there is no more water left, we will no longer be here.
Frank is a Hoopa tribal member and Yurok descendant. She says the Trinity River runs through her homeland.
Our river has been declining in health for decades.
The river has been dammed, and water from the Trinity is often diverted to the Central Valley. Frank says those diversions, combined with droughts and global warming, are causing fish kills.
the water levels are dropping so low that the water temperatures are skyrocketing to temperatures that salmon, not only can they not thrive, can they not spawn, they cannot survive in these areas.
So she's pushing for change. As the youth coordinator for the nonprofit Save California Salmon, Frank helps young people maintain their connection to the river and learn how to influence water policy.
We only get to continue living the way that we're meant to if our rivers are running freely, if our salmon are still there in our communities, and if we understand the way that these decisions are made and we can influence them.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.